Welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. I'm your host, David Yosefon, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law in sunny Santa Clara, California. In this episode, we examine the often unseen moral consequences of the investments of millions of ordinary Americans through conventional retirement savings accounts and conventional mutual funds. We also examine the work that investor activists are doing to try to make large financial institutions more responsive to the moral and ethical concerns that are wrapped up in their investment activity. We do so by talking not with a scholar, but with an individual who runs an organization that is presently actively engaged in these kinds of investor activist undertakings. Please subscribe to this Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at David Yosefon. That's at David Yosefon at David Yosefon. And I tweet it out anytime that I'm posting a new episode in this podcast series. Also, if you're on Twitter and you see me posting an episode that you think is interesting or that you think your followers might be interested in, please retweet it. We'd greatly appreciate that. I'm coming to understand better how the Twitter universe works and the way that we really can get the social network going and get the podcast to the ears of a broader audience is if those who find it initially interesting can retweet it and pass it along to those who they may know of who may be interested in our subject matter. We are sponsored by the Markla Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, and we're grateful for their sponsorship. With me now is Eric Cohen, co-founder and chairperson of Investors Against Genocide. Eric, thanks so much for being a part of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast.
Hi, David. Glad to be here.
So what is Investors Against Genocide and what does it do?
Investors Against Genocide is a little NGO, all volunteer, that works on the problem of mutual funds and other financial institutions making large investments in the very worst companies supporting the very worst regimes in the world. So specifically, we work with individuals, financial firms, pensions and endowment managers and government officials to encourage investment firms to change their investing strategies and avoid investments in companies that substantially contribute to genocide or crimes against humanity. In the case of Sudan, what this means is the oil companies that are partnering with the government of Sudan and providing most of the revenue that the government uses, which by having that revenue, it can afford to wage war against its own people. In the case of Sudan, the specific companies involved are PetroChina CNPC Group, the China Petroleum and Chemical Corporation, which is part of the Sinopec Group, ONGC, and Petronas. Those are all foreign oil companies, and there's a reason why they're all foreign, and that is that U.S. oil companies have not been allowed by law to do business in any part of the oil or petroleum industry in Sudan since 1996 when Bill Clinton was president. And so what we have is foreign oil companies, these four are Chinese, Indian, and Malaysian, that are doing the work. So it's an oddity of U.S. law that ExxonMobil, for instance, is precluded by law from doing anything with regard to the petroleum industry in Sudan, but its competitors, such as PetroChina, Sinopec, ONGC, and Petronas, not only are allowed to do that, but U.S. financial institutions invest many billions of dollars in ExxonMobil's competitors while they do that work.
So it really is kind of an incoherent public policy from the domestic standpoint that U.S. companies as such are forbidden from doing business there, but U.S. capital in the form of the retirement savings of millions of ordinary Americans invested through conventional retirement investment accounts is able to be invested there. And in so doing, is supporting these genocidal operations.
That's right. It is incoherent. Or another way to put it is the letter of the law allows this to be legal, but spirit of the law is clearly being broken by U.S. financial institutions putting billions of dollars of Americans' money into these companies that are supporting the very worst regimes. If you step back and think of it, though, just as an example for PetroChina, which is part of the CNPC group of China and China Petroleum and Chemical Corporation, part of the Sinopec group, Sinopec and CNPC are both owned by the government of China. They have publicly traded arms, which they use to do much of their work, and they are publicly traded because those companies wanted to raise capital in the West. And they have raised many billions of dollars, not just with one public offering, but multiple public offerings and many bond offerings. So they're playing the corporate game of getting access to Western capital markets. And that's really important to them. So that's why they're in it. That's why they're publicly traded.
And so what financial institutions are we talking about in the United States?
Well, there's a part of the market that are officially socially responsible investing companies, SRIs, and none of them have any problem in this area. They don't need any help from me to avoid investments tied to genocide. They're working on important problems, but problems of human rights or social issues that I would say are at a different level than what we're aiming at, which is genocide and crimes against humanity. So the SRIs don't need any of our help. And unfortunately, the institutions that are not SRIs overwhelmingly are to more or less an extent investing in these worst companies. So specifically, some of the biggest shareholders in PetroChina and Sinopec are names you'll recognize because there are people like J.P. Morgan Chase. There are people like BlackRock. There are people like Franklin Resources, Vanguard, and Fidelity. All are big shareholders and don't want to stop being big shareholders in these companies. Now, since we've begun our work, I'm glad to say that we have engaged with a great many financial institutions, and although most of them are very resistant to doing anything about this problem, we did achieve some successes, and we're very glad to point to TIA Cref and T. Rowe Price, both of which are very large asset managers, as having policies and taken action, substantial action, to avoid investments tied to genocide. In the case of TIA Cref, after significant discussions with them over the course of several years, they did decide to agree with us and actually did a press release on the subject, saying they were very concerned, and subsequently sought much higher level engagement with the management of these companies. And when that failed, they announced publicly divesting from PetroChina, for instance, and a few others. And in the case of T. Rowe Price, they did not do any press releases, but they developed a strong policy, and they did sell a few hundred million dollars of these oil companies that they had once held, and they have a strong policy that prevents it happening again, and they're not afraid to talk about it privately to industry colleagues, but unlike TI Cref, did not do a press release. So there's some successes, and we're glad to see from looking at T. Rowe Price and TI Cref that financial institutions are capable of doing it if they want to make an effort. And the problem we see with the financial industry is not that the J.P. Morgans of the world are making an effort and they're doing it badly. The problem we see is they're not even trying.
When we consider that when we talk about Fidelity or J.P. Morgan or Vanguard, you know, those are corporate names, but the money that is invested in them are the retirement savings, the retirement funds and general savings of millions of ordinary Americans who may know that they're invested in Vanguard, may know they're invested in Fidelity, but don't attend to what specific corporations those funds are investing in. But if we polled those Americans, as you provide some data on your website, if we polled ordinary Americans, by wide margins, they would say, We don't support genocide. We don't want our retirement invested in genocide. And yet they're in these financial vehicles that do put their savings directly into these companies that are doing business in genocidal regimes. So there is something of a gap there, might call it an agency problem or a slack between the genuine desires of the ultimate holders of these capital, ordinary Americans, and their investment managers in these corporations. So why are these investment funds, these financial institutions, how do you account for that gap? Why are the financial institutions not responsive to the almost commonsensical, but certainly sincere moral outlook of their investors?
Yeah, it's pretty astounding that they don't. Are just to cite one of the survey elements that we brought forward in the research. When asked, 95% of Americans over the age of 18 who have a household income of $50,000 or more want no connection of their savings, pension funds, their family's money to genocide. So you'd think that a financial institution like Fidelity, it has something like 40 million registered customers and wants every other family in America who's not already their customer to be their customer. You'd think that a number like that, 95% of the public, would mean that they would want to do what the public wants and by doing so cement their relationship with their customers. But it's not so. They don't. We've provided that information to them, the research about the problem companies, about what's happening in Sudan, about what the public wants, and Fidelity chooses to disregard that. Now, when we've talked to people in the financial industry, I mentioned Fidelity just a minute ago, but the problem is much broader than Fidelity, and I think that their thinking goes something like this. They've made a decision not to be an SRI. So Fidelity is not an SRI, so when you come along to them and talk to them about a human rights problem, no matter how egregious, their reaction is, well, they don't really deal with those questions. That's not up to them. Of course, it would be natural for them to do it if they were an SRI, but it's just not something that they do. So they've grown up as financial professionals, sort of like elves, looking at elf-like things and want to look at nothing else. And when you ask them to consider something else, in the case of Fidelity, they actually published that they think it's a really terrible thing happening in Sudan and government ought to do something about it because it's not their problem at Fidelity.
Mm-hmm. Government ought to do something. So the we have to assume, I would think, that that the natural people who are running these financial institutions are not so craven distinctly immoral that they genuinely don't care about genocide so much as they hold the view that they have a particular role to play, a legal role, a social role, and that does not include attending to politics in the Sudan, and there must be in other institutions, international or domestic, that have that responsibility.
That's right, and it's quite a contrast in comparison to having the discussion with T. Rowe Price, who, after considering it, said, and says today, that there are risks associated with having investments in companies that are tied to that level of crime, genocide and crimes against humanity. These are really terrible things, and they didn't see any necessity to expose their shareholders, their customers, to those risks. What a difference.
Well, I want to ask you about the legitimacy of this distinction between being an SRI and not. I mean, why? SRI, again, being a socially responsible investment vehicle. And there are many funds that promote themselves as SRIs. And so given that there are SRI funds available, does this suggest that that ordinary Americans who might respond to a survey and say, oh, sure, I care about the people in the Sudan and I don't want my money going there, But the fact that they don't then invest in SRIs but are content to have their savings put into these more general funds, does that suggest that they're not really genuinely committed to the anti-genocidal investment, and therefore Fidelity is actually just showing fidelity, if you will, to the revealed pref investors?
No, I don't think it demonstrates that at all. When I had a discussion with the president of TIAA-CREF as they were thinking about what they were going to do, I suggested to him that if he had any question about this, all he had to do was offer two funds to his customers. One that was a general fund that did not have a restriction and would invest in companies like PetroChina, Sinopeco, NGC, and Petronas, and another that would make a commitment to not do it. And if he offered those two things to his customers, I was pretty sure what would happen. And I told him what would happen is that people, to an overwhelming degree, would choose to the fund that was genocide-free by avoiding connections to those examples. That would have been a real test. What we have in the example of Fidelity is a different kind of situation, and that is Fidelity is huge. They're tied into so many companies and enterprises, 401k or 403b plans. They have a dominant position in the industry, and so what you get when you sign up with them as the big player is the rest of their baggage. And you don't know what the rest of their baggage is. Now, it's an accident that I happen to know about it, and I was shocked when I discovered, and it is a regular thing for me to discover when I talk to people about this problem. They're shocked to discover that in this day and age, it's even a question that a big financial institution, trusted, high-quality, professional outfit like Fidelity wouldn't automatically be avoiding such problems. After all, they're careful stock pickers. They do analysis on thousands and thousands of stocks, and the universe of investing is so large, wouldn't it be natural that they would weed out these problems? When we did the research about what public opinions were, what we discovered is that very few people have any idea that in this day and age, the financial institutions would be investing in companies tied to genocide. So people don't know it's happening. But even if you thought that it was happening, you would have to have very specialized knowledge, detailed knowledge of the market, to know that PetroChina was a problem company because it was the publicly traded arm of CNPC, and CNPC is the largest partner with the government of Sudan in exploiting its oil industry, and as a result, the largest funder of that genocidal government. That's a lot to know. That's a lot to uncover, so it's not a surprise to me that few people have any idea that this is going on. And it's because that we accidentally stumbled into this that we, I and my two colleagues, the three of us who founded the work at Investors Against Genocide, have been continuing to work on this because we would like the financial industry to learn something from what is now 11 years of the genocide in Darfur, Sudan, and also to make a commitment to react differently to other such cases should they come up in the future. Because without them helping us, you need specialized knowledge. Now, just to show you how easy it is to fall into the trap of getting stuck with these kind of investments, you only have to go back to when Republicans and Democrats running for president. Eventually, the presidency was won by Barack Obama, but Barack Obama, his Democratic competitors, and his Republican competitors, all sometime during that election campaign season, discovered that their 401ks, their 403bs, their mutual funds that they and their families owned included PetroChina or Petronas or Sinopec or ONGC. And you know what they did when they discovered it? They said, oh my God, and they sold them.
Yeah.
But just think, if those well-informed, politically connected families who have access to many experts and who are politically really focused and are very much aware because of their positions of what's going on in the world and how these questions are debated. Barack Obama, who as a senator suggested a genocide-free investing policy for the federal thrift program, and yet still he found himself, as did the other candidates, with investments that were tied with genocide. If they fall victim by accident, how can any ordinary American take care of it themselves? And the answer is, we can't. We rely on the people, the financial institutions that we trust, and we want them to take care of it for us. And that's why when we discuss this problem with J.P. Morgan or Fidelity or Vanguard or Franklin Resources or whomever, we put this in front of them as a broad-based general concern of the American public, and we need their help in order to address it to a reasonable level. We're not asking J.P. Morgan to become an SRI. We're not even asking them to be perfect on Sudan. If you go back in time, there used to be a Sudan divestment task force that would identify who companies were who were helping the regime in Sudan, and they came up with, depending on the time, 2 to 3 dozen companies that were problems. But if you rank ordered them, at the top of the list were the obvious cases of the oil companies, the ones I just named. We're not asking J.P. Morgan to be perfect on Sudan and figure them all out, but at least handle the things that are obvious. And that's why when we do shareholder proposals at J.P. Morgan Chase or these other financial institutions, we ask them to make efforts to avoid investments in companies that substantially contribute to genocide or crimes of humanity, and we ask them to do it only when it's in their own judgment. We want them to have the leeway to make the decision. We want them to be able to deal with just the most substantial and significant problems. That will be a really important contribution, and those should not be controversial. By the time you get down to number 10 or 20 on the list, they're lower on the list because the cases are not so clear. But the oil companies providing the most revenue to the government of Sudan are pretty obvious cases. It's easy to explain them. It's actually not controversial to go after them and see the connection. That's why in the United States, some 30 states made the decision to avoid investments in those four oil companies. 30 states, and most of those were legislative processes, each one of which was a painful slog through public policy that took typically 2 or 3 years. The fact that the public went through such work, such agonizing, painstaking work, and pushed it through over the course of years tells you that it really connects with the public at large, and that's why it became law in state after state, and also at some 60 colleges and universities. But the problem is it was never Harvard University or Yale or Princeton or Stanford or any of the other 60 colleges or universities that made a decision to avoid these companies. And it was never Massachusetts or New York or California or Texas or the rest of the 30 states that decided to avoid these investments. The big investors were always the financial institutions, and that's why it's so important that we take the issue to them.
I think you really make the economic case for why the financial institutions must play a role monitoring at least the worst kinds of human rights abuses. One of the great benefits of the corporate form, of the publicly traded corporation and of these mutual funds, is that it provides investors with the opportunity to be rationally ignorant about their investments. It allows for them to invest in highly diversified fashion and therefore have the confidence that they need to not have to spend the time exhaustively evaluating the business operations or the ethical implications of any one firm that they're invested in. If we put that onus on the individual shareholder, they'll be much more reluctant to invest, and the cost of aggregating capital will be much, much greater, and the difficulty of engaging in socially useful business enterprise will become preclusive. People will hide their money under their mattresses or plow it into real estate, and we lose the social utility of that aggregated capital. We typically celebrate shareholder ignorance or rational shareholder ignorance when it comes to ordinary business operations. We don't want shareholders involved in ordinary business operations. So we can't then, at the end of the day, assert that, the shareholders haven't invested in SRIs, and therefore we have no obligation to monitor the genocidal entanglement of these firms. And I think it also, we need to appreciate the default of our of the structure of many of our retirement funds, that I'm sure is exactly what entangled President Obama, or then Senator Obama, and other candidates. You know, when your retirements are being managed by your employer, you might have the opportunity to move your investments out of the default savings vehicles into some kind of an SRI. But even that takes some heavy transactions costs. And when you've got a job to do and kids to raise, and you want to try to exercise, and you're engaged in more locally in your community, you don't necessarily have the cognitive capacity to be evaluating the prospectuses of these various investment funds. So you tend to stick with the default, and the default is going to be, as you say, a seemingly responsible large public entity like Fidelity or Vanguard. And so you just stick with the default, and then lo and behold, it turns out you find yourself perhaps shockingly, embarrassingly, or repugnantly invested in these operations.
And that's exactly what happened to every one of those presidential candidates who had to move their money on both sides of the aisle. It was quite striking to see. Yeah, you know, ordinary people disagree with each other about what constitutes ethical investing. There are some people that place it at one extreme end or another extreme end, that care more about the environment, care more about human rights. There are many different ways to look at this. And in general, the SRIs try to do a good job in every one of those dimensions, which is a right choice for many people. But for most people, they're not trying to work all issues at once, but they want a basic level of decency. And it's those people that we argue constitute that 95%. And that's why mainstream firms like T. Rowe Price and TIAA Cref are seeking to take care of their customers at large, and that's why these other companies like JP Morgan and Vanguard and Fidelity ought to be doing it as well, but they're not.
Can you talk a little bit about what mechanisms you use, your Investors Against Genocide? So it's different than taking to the street or holding a march or a sit-in, or, you know, an artistic form of protest. Tell us about the mechanisms that you used as Investors Against Genocide.
Well, we've tried several things at this point, and the reason why we keep having more and more is that we see that some are failing. And we've evolved to a few that we think are pretty effective. When we first started, we thought the problem was that the executives at Fidelity just didn't know. And so we wrote them letters and explained to them what was happening in Sudan, and in quoting famous person after famous person about why it was important and significant and real. It wasn't just us writing as nobodies. And after several months of writing those letters and trying to educate people, we received only one form letter ever in response, and it was the one that I was paraphrasing to you earlier, which is that things in Sudan sound really terrible, and it's not their job at Fidelity to deal with it, and so they're going to do nothing, but they hope government or someone else deals with it. So that was the official response we got to all our letters. And we wrote to many individuals, every board member we could find, every significant portfolio manager. We did a good job of researching and writing letters and getting them out to people. So then we tried a second tack, and the second tack was to get a little bit of publicity and get people to send complaints. And over the course of some months, we signed up ourselves to do a little website and to complain about it, and connected with other established NGOs and got them to complain or have their members complain. And in the course of events of just a short number of months, single-digit level number of months, we got more than 250,000 confirmed complaints to Fidelity and other financial institutions. And I say confirmed because we could count the number of emails that went, because we were copied or the numbers were stored in databases. But what we couldn't count was how many people made phone calls, how many people wrote letters. They weren't countable, we don't know. But at least we had 250,000. To us, that sounded like a big number. And we thought, geez, you know, if we even hit 50,000, you know, that ought to get the attention. But no, we hit 250,000. And the result was nothing. nothing. No difference from Fidelity. As part of our work, we were to gain attention for the problem. Newspapers began writing about it. There was a story in the Boston area from the local Fox affiliate who sought to interview people at Fidelity, and they gave them, for the record, the same answers that they had given us. Fidelity, by the way, Boston's significant for Fidelity because Fidelity's headquarters are in downtown Boston. Fidelity is the largest employer in the state, or at least it was at the time, second only to the state itself. And, you know, everybody, I have friends who work there. My money was at Fidelity. My friend's money was at Fidelity. So this is their backyard. They own the place. So there were a lot of people from this area who were complaining, and it got a lot of news here. But it didn't faze them. So the third, we sought to do more publicity and continue to talk to newspapers whenever we can get their interest, or to people who are doing blogs or podcasts. So we're glad to help educate people, because if only they knew, they can raise their voice. And anyone who hears this podcast, I'd encourage you to call your financial institution and ask them what their policy is with regard to genocide-free investing. And if you're a Fidelity customer, a Vanguard customer, or a Franklin Templeton customer, or a J.P. Morgan customer, or a BlackRock customer, they all have problems, I can tell you right now. But whoever you have your business with, ask them and get the word out.
But let me interrupt you there and ask you, when you make that call, and maybe some of our listeners do want to make that call, who do you ask for? I mean, I wonder if the reason you send 250,000 messages, but there's just maybe no office in these institutions that is available really to receive them, so that maybe they go to the media relations people and kind of get buried. Are they set up to receive such a complaint? Literally, who do you ask for?
Yeah, so many people are holding Fidelity shares because their company has a relationship with Fidelity, because Fidelity runs their 401k. So if that is the case for you, call the person who's the relationship manager, because they have a job to pass it on, to pass it on, to pass it on. And it turns out that companies like Fidelity really care about their customer service. And until we explored this problem with Fidelity, I was aware that their customer service was excellent. Not in this dimension, but in general. And many of these companies really have excellent customer service, and they deliver the message to the right people. But the problem is their executive management doesn't want to deal with the problem. So in the case of Fidelity, we know that exhaustively. I can tell you, in the case of J.P. Morgan Chase, their senior management, right through to Jamie Dimon, knows about this problem and does not want to deal with it. I can tell you the same thing about Vanguard. I can tell you the same thing about BlackRock, because we tried to talk to their executive management. And one of the main reasons we've been successful talking to executive management is the next tactic that we adopted, and we are still doing, and that is submitting shareholder proposals to mutual fund after mutual fund to make their board of directors, when they have meetings, consider the issue, and to the corporations where there is a public corporation that owns the fund complex, like J.P. Morgan, the corporation, or Franklin Resources, the corporation who's the parent of Franklin and Templeton and Franklin Templeton mutual funds. So we go to the corporate parent and to the board of trustees with our shareholder proposals. And because we submit them and eventually there are shareholder meetings, we get to talk directly to executive management and offer to talk, of course, in advance, because we'd much rather work with them to fix their policy than argue with them in public. But what gets us to talk with them is the threat of a shareholder meeting. And some of them have extensive discussions with us, and some refuse to talk with us. Franklin Resources refuse to discuss things. But there's at least a little bit of chance for a discussion at the shareholder meeting, because we present the proposal in a public forum.
So the shareholder proposal mechanism is a vehicle that is provided for by the federal securities laws, which allows shareholders, if they own $2,000 worth of stock in a publicly traded corporation, to author a proposal that relates to the business that they're invested in, and to have that proposal contained in the company's proxy materials that it distributes to the rest of the shareholders in connection with ordinary corporate ordinary shareholder meetings, and the shareholder proposal mechanism allows for this proposal to be put before the shareholders and put to a vote. And so this is the mechanism that you're making use of. And what I'm hearing you say is that it's that you put the proposal before the shareholders, and perhaps you get some response from the other shareholders. But if am I hearing that what's really valuable to you is that when you've got the proposal on the proxy, that gives you the occasion to speak at the shareholder meeting and address the directors directly?
That's right. And in for some companies, maybe even more importantly, is that once you're submitted, you have their attention. And long before the proxy is published and long before the meeting actually happens, they're interested in talking to you. So for instance, this year, we submitted a shareholder proposal to Goldman Sachs. They were never one of the largest shareholders, but they were a significant shareholder in the oil companies in Sudan that I keep using as examples. But they were never close to what J.P. Morgan was, or Franklin Resources, for example. And when we submitted, they said, well, they wanted to take us up on our offer to discuss the problems and what they might be able to do about them. And we've had, at this point, three or four extensive discussions with them. They have interest in improving their policies and improving their disclosures. And so we withdrew from withdrew our proposal that would have been on their ballot. It was just, as a result, it was not on their ballot. We officially withdrew, and we're continuing discussions with them about how to deal with it. Slightly different thing happened with J.P. Morgan. Every year we submitted, they had meetings with us, discussed things with us for a couple hours, and then ignored everything we said. And it went on the ballot, and there was a vote, and they claimed that their policies were all sufficient, despite the fact that they held more than $3 billion worth of stock in these oil companies, and often even served as book runner for bond offerings from companies like CNPC, who had a $2 billion U.S. Bond offering that J.P. Morgan was helping facilitate. So there was a case where they talked to us, but nothing was forthcoming in terms of what would be adjusting in, even considered to be adjusted in their corporate plans, and it continued onto the ballot, and it's had votes. And then at the other extreme, and there's Franklin Resources, which never wanted to talk to us, declined our offers every year. And so the only time we talk to them is when we show up in the shareholder meeting that happens annually out in California. And that discussion is very formal because we've submitted a 500-word proposal with arguments into their proxy materials, and we make a speech for all of 3 minutes. And then if we're lucky, we get to ask one or two questions at the meeting before they cut us off. Not so they have control, and they can stifle the discussion, or, like we experienced with Goldman Sachs, have deepened, we hope, what will ultimately be fruitful conversations. So it takes all kinds, and we've experienced all manner of extremes.
Have you had any success with the proposals themselves, in terms of shareholders voting in favor? I imagine the proposals call for the fund to consider divesting or something of the sort. Have you had any luck with the questions themselves?
Yeah. So specifically on the proposal, we've been tweaking our wording every year as we try to make ourselves more effective, but it's essentially the same all the time. And just to run through it quickly for you, shareholders request that the board institute transparent procedures to avoid holding or recommending investments in companies that, in management's judgment, substantially contribute to genocide or crimes against humanity. So there's more words in the 500, but that's the key sentence in the resolve clause. So the best success we had was when we withdrew our shareholder proposals from TIAA-CREF and T. Rowe Price because, in short, they decided to agree with us. It's much better to not need to come to a vote.
So that's part of the leverage of the mechanism is you threaten to author a shareholder proposal, and now the firm is more responsive to you than they would be absent that stick.
Exactly. Like, as in all negotiations, if there's a time constraint, then the issues can get brought to a head. If there's no time constraint, you can talk forever. So So this is an old thing in negotiations, and we see this with shareholder meetings too. Corporations are required; public corporations are required by law to have an annual shareholder meeting. Almost no mutual fund is required to have a shareholder meeting on an annual basis. They might wait 5 or 10 years, who knows? Or they might have them every year if they feel like they need it for some reason. Very few are required by law to have meetings. So so discussions are really driven in a timely manner with corporations, but with the mutual funds, as they say, because few of them are required by law to have meetings, they wait a long time before it's time to discuss anything with us, if indeed ever they want to discuss anything with us. So back to your question about what success we've had with the vote. In our early days with Fidelity, we just were lucky that Fidelity, for its own reasons, needed to have meetings to adjust some of the bylaws in terms of their funds. So it turned out over the course of a few years, we've had many meetings, many different funds, many different days that we had the ballots there. And Fidelity's statement of opposition was pretty straightforward. They said, in short, as I paraphrase, that it's a serious problem and government should do something about it. Everything they're doing is legal and they shouldn't do any more than that. And so relatively straightforward. It wasn't, they weren't trying to confuse any shareholders. Our highest in favor response was 31% of the ayes, nays, and abstentions. So 31%. Typically, we would get 25 to 30, high 20s, occasionally low 20s in these votes at Fidelity. Since most social issues would get low single digits, even a 15% or 20% kind of number should have been an earthquake for Fidelity, let alone 25, 28, or 31. But nonetheless, they decided to ignore it. We had so many votes at Fidelity, we literally could count that millions of their shareholders, literally millions of their shareholders, voted against their recommendation. Fidelity and most other financial institutions, when it goes on the ballot, they strongly oppose it, and they write their 500 words to explain why they should oppose it. And when a company opposes the proposal, that's a big thumb on the scale for all shareholders. And the reason is that shareholders decide to invest with Fidelity or whatever the company is because they decided to trust them. So there's a natural bias to support management, whatever it is they want. After all, you're trusting them with your life savings. So that's point one. And point two is most ordinary investors don't care what's on the ballot because they've seen the ballots, and what's usually on the ballot is voting for these directors, none of whom you know personally, all of whom are recommended by the board, so, you know, what can you say about that? And voting for the some obscure rules that you can't make sense of about if they're changing the bylaws, and voting for who their auditor is. None of those things grabs people's interest in general, so most ordinary people simply throw their ballots away, along with 100 pages of onion skin that accompany it, that it explain all the details of the proxy voting. So what we've done with our shareholder proposal is try to write it in such a way that it can be summarized quickly in the sentence that I read to you, or simply by calling it Genocide Free Investing. Either one of ways to represent it on the ballot is acceptable to us. And if you just read that one sentence, though, you get a pretty good idea with what's at stake. And it should get your attention because of the wording that's used. After all, you don't see resolutions related to genocide too often. And so what we hope for is that the company would see it as something that they didn't want to oppose because it would be embarrassing to oppose, and that normal people, if they even read that one sentence, they'll want to be supporting it, and they'll be upset with the company if the company is opposing it. And maybe they'll even be led to open the 100 pages of onion skin document that came with the proxy materials and read the rest of what we said and read what the company said. But even if they don't do that, we definitely are getting their attention. So that goes to some of our strategy for how we wrote the proposal. And I should say, for us, it was very important to use the words genocide or crimes against humanity. That's the phrase that we use here. And the reason is that those are defined terms. People have heard of them, and even though I'm familiar with the definition because I'm living with this every day. Even people who are not familiar with the definition know that they're really horrible. And anybody who reads the definition of genocide or crimes against humanity gets educated in spades that they're really horrible. So it's not like some sliding scale of human rights concerns that maybe someone might think we're asking a company to care about things that are arguable. Genocide and crimes against humanity don't seem like arguable things. And then adding that we're asking them to act when it's in management's judgment that they substantially contribute to those kind of crimes, where's the wiggle room to say that that might be a bad idea? So that's part of our strategy for having written it that way, and that's partly why we've done so well. I have to say that many financial institutions, not Fidelity but others, have written very confusing statements of opposition. And when they write confusing statements of opposition, we don't do nearly as well. And we don't do nearly as well when, as with J.P. Morgan, 74% of their shareholders, 70% of all shares owned in J.P. Morgan, who have a possibility to vote, are owned by other financial institutions, because most financial institutions are voting against us. They're not ordinary people deciding what to do.
Right. So when you look at, you know, it's when you say, you might be surprised to see only 31% of those who actually voted in favor of the proposal. But again, you've got the rational ignorance that most shareholders aren't even reviewing the proxy materials. Those that are reviewing them might be defaulting to management, but those who are voting are not the natural person, individual shareholders that are expressing moral opposition, but those that are voting are themselves institutional holders that themselves might be acting in what they take to be a fiduciary capacity, thinking, well, you know, we oppose genocide, but it's not our role. Let government do it.
Yeah, and it's there are so many barriers to a shareholder proposal being successful. Some of them we've mentioned. Another one, of course, is that it often had been easy to vote with management, and if you don't vote or if you abstain, that usually counts as a vote against proposals when they're shareholder proposals. So there are all these things, and then you get to the companies like D.F. King that the Fidelities of the World hire, in order to follow up with shareholders to get them to vote. And so what these solicitation companies do, paid by Fidelity, is if Fidelity isn't getting enough people to submit the proxy votes, they hire D.F. King, and then D.F. King makes calls to them at home to talk to them. And it's not funny what happens when these guys call. And it just so happened that one of the guys they called was a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and he writes about his experience in an article entitled Blood Money on Wall Street. And what happened was the same thing that to him has happened for millions of people that they solicited. And happened to me because I experienced the same thing. They call up and they say, management has very carefully considered these questions, and they want you to vote in favor of questions 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and against the shareholder proposal number 6, and we've considered these things very carefully. May I register your vote today as management recommends? Mm. And they haven't read you a single question mm-hmm. at this point. And, you know, few people want to be talking on the phone with solicitors of any sort. So what do you think happens? Well, if you're sophisticated, you might start asking additional questions. But most people aren't, and so the whole conversation is geared to getting votes the way management wants, and so much of the system is slanted in this way. So I won't get into many other examples, but it's pretty striking as you get into it. Nonetheless, we've had one case where we outright won, and that was a very unusual case. It was a mutual fund from the ING firm, with the ING Emerging Countries Fund. And what was so unusual about it was that management at that fund decided not to recommend against it, but to be neutral and have their shareholders decide on their own. So this is exactly what we've proposed in every vote for any of the companies or mutual funds that we've been at. If you don't want to agree with us, then let your customers decide for themselves and be neutral and see what they say. Mm-hmm. Well, this is what ING Emerging Countries Fund did. And the result of the vote was 59% in favor, 10% against. And if you do the math, that's 85% of those expressing an opinion voted for the proposal, very close to the kind of numbers that we'd expect from our public opinion polling. When people got to express themselves and think about themselves, when they couldn't automatically have things filled in and had to check yes or no what they wanted and had to think about themselves, that's what they said.
This shareholder proposal mechanism is a controversial device. The Securities and Exchange Commission, as some of our listeners may know, others may not know, is run by a 5-member commission, no more than three of whom may be from any one party. So it's sort of got some nonpartisan or bipartisanship baked into its structure. But one of the present commissioners, a Republican commissioner, Daniel Gallagher, recently gave a speech where he was really targeting the shareholder proposal mechanism and suggesting that he wants to lead the commission to undertake serious reforms that would make it much more difficult for activist groups like yours to have access to the mechanism. He described the $2,000 worth of shares threshold to be absurdly low and has suggested raising it to something like $200,000, or he said even $2 million. And he made in this speech arguments that have been familiar for a long time in the academic literature, suggesting that the shareholder proposal mechanism is a vehicle for iconoclasts or ideologues or gadflies that detract from management's attention on the business of the firm, and that is essentially operates as a tax on most shareholders who are uninterested in the proposals that come out of them. I'm sure you were attentive to Commissioner Gallagher's comments, and I wanted to give you the opportunity to respond to them.
Yes, we were horrified by his proposals. And if adopted, if the other commissioners supported him, and if Congress and the President let him get away with it, it would have a crushing effect on the ability of shareholders to engage in important questions of governance. It's akin, in my view, to changing the rules for what would happen for engaging in questions about corporations, to limit them to only much less than the 1% of the 1%. It would be the Carl Icahns of the world only who could be discussing what should happen in corporations rather than ordinary investors. And I know for our efforts, if there was anything like his proposals adopted, we would not be able to bring the issue of genocide pre-investing to the fore and force boards and executive management to address it and take a position. And certainly in our case, it's easy to generate how significant a social issue it is and how broad-based the support is for the issue that we're putting on the table. That Commissioner Gallagher's proposal would eliminate that and would have a crushing effect on us, even when it's the vast majority of Americans are agreeing with us. So he's hugely gone too far. The other thing is that he ignores the safeguards that are already built into the process. Now, it would be one thing if you were recommending some tweaking of the existing rules and strengthening of some of the safeguards in minor ways, but his proposals are quite extremely radical. They're not improving the process. They're throwing it out and replacing it with something that would look and feel and be completely different. Just as an example of an important safeguard already in the process is that the rules for submitting shareholder proposals say that a corporation or the mutual fund, whoever the entity is, can challenge the right of the proposal to get on the ballot, and the SEC, they can raise it to the SEC. They don't even have to go to court to do this. They can always go to court, but they can go to the SEC, and the SEC has administrative rules. And there are a lot of safeguards built in. For instance, Any issue that is considered to be ordinary business of the corporation is not an issue that's deemed suitable for a shareholder proposal. And so the question is the issue something that is just interfering with ordinary business? And that's a filter that eliminates many, many nuisance things, things that are not important. It's a really important filter. Now, some corporations, including J.P. Morgan and Fidelity, have tried this argument on our proposal and said we'd be interfering with their ordinary business with trying to raise the issue we were raising, and we had to counter their arguments at the SEC in discussion of this in order to protect our place in the ballot. And it wasn't hard for us to demonstrate that the issue we're putting on the table is one that is a significant social policy question that is of great and broad interest across America, and you've heard me reference some of the facts and figures that support that. So it's for that reason that we get to be on the ballot. Now, I suppose that Commissioner Gallagher may be able to come up with some example of an unimportant, an insignificant, a nuisance kind of measure that made it onto the ballot. And if he can do that, he should reference it, and he should think about how the rules should be tweaked so that whatever that issue is gets filtered out by the rules. But as it is, most things are already filtered out, but big policy questions get through, and they get to be brought before corporate boards. And what we know from experience, whether it's about pay policies or classified boards, which are common shareholder proposals, or ours, that it takes many times on the ballot for ordinary shareholders to be connecting with the issues and deciding that they support them, and therefore they grow over time if they are indeed significant issues. And indeed, the SEC has rules that if you are only at the nuisance level, if you only get 1% of support for your resolution, you don't get to come back the next year. And there are increasing levels that you have to meet if you're going to be coming back year after year after year. But if you're typically getting 25% or 30%, you know, that's significant, and why should anyone exclude you, even if you only represented your own $3,000? And that's the counter-argument to Commissioner Gallagher. So if he wants to reform and tweak, I'm all for that, and I can't wait to hear what he might propose.
We're almost out of time, but I want to give you the switching from a defensive to an offensive posture. What reform, either to the shareholder proposal mechanism or some other element of the regulatory architecture, what reform would you advocate that would institutionally or in terms of legal structure make our investment funds, our financial institutions more responsive to the genuine, sincere moral predilections of the vast majority of capital holders in the United States?
David, I don't have really important suggestions for improving the shareholder proposal system, but I do have really significant proposals that we think will make a huge difference for transparency and disclosure that apply to our issue. And I think that after I describe them to you, you might be able to see how they might be able to revolutionize more broadly questions about transparency and disclosure. So let me share those with you. And this is work that we've developed at Investors Against Genocide over the course of time, and we've discuss this with members of Congress, and we're hoping to get support. And here's why we think we need different transparency and disclosure rules. If you look at J.P. Morgan Chase, for instance, and look at their website, what you find is that there will be a section on human rights and corporate responsibility, and you can download documents, sometimes very long documents, about their corporate social responsibility. And you can download multicolored flyers that might have 5 or 10 pages about their thinking about human rights policy. And if you go to their website, you'll see published statements where Jamie Dimon says that being a good corporate citizen is essential in everything that they do. and you'll see that they've signed on to the UN Principles for Responsible Investing and the Extractive Industry Transparency Rules. And if you heard of a good thing anywhere in the world, they signed on to it. So all of that is right there in front of you, and you have cognitive dissonance connecting how great they sound on their website and with all these commitments they've made. And how do you square that with the fact that they have multi-billion dollar investments in the worst regimes supporting, in the worst companies supporting the worst regimes in the world? And it's not by accident, because they're doing it year after year despite our engaging and educating them. So it's not like an accident somehow. And the answer is you can't square this circle. It's a problem. It's a disconnect. And the reason is all those glossies, all those statements sound good, but they're really carefully worded so that they commit actually nothing. UN Principles for Responsible Investing that J.P. Morgan has signed on to, for instance, say that they will consider human rights issues in their investment decision-making process. So you'd think that, okay, you don't have to argue with them to consider it. These are really terrible things. They must be considering it. How could they decide anything but to avoid major investments in these companies? And yet they are. And they pledge, as part of UNPRI, to be aligning their work with the general interests of society and that we're all a part of. Well, if that's the case, wouldn't it be nice if they made an effort to not invest in supporting companies that were funding genocide? You'd think that that would be natural fallout, and yet it's not. And this all goes back to the fact that they're doing marketing by signing onto these things. And maybe they mean it, and maybe they want to mean it, but so far at least they don't want to mean it so much that it's to a significant degree affecting how they're doing their business. So we want a different transparency and disclosure rule. So just imagine if there was a transparency and disclosure rule required by Congress, so that in a prospectus, for instance, every financial institution had to answer the question in the prospectus that this fund or this company, a yes-no question, does the firm consider human rights questions when they make investment decisions, yes or no? Does the fund or the company make an effort to avoid investments that substantially contribute to genocide or crimes against humanity? Just yes or no. We think if those questions were asked, that every company and every fund would want to say yes to them, and they would really not want to say no. And the reason is that yes and no questions are, you can tabulate them, lay them out in a table, and the no's and the yes's really differentiate themselves. But you cannot differentiate the glossies at J.P. Morgan from anybody else's glossies. It's impossible, because it's really unclear what they've committed, although it sure sounds good. But yes and no you can get. And there's a second element of this. Today, lawyers, and some of you listening to this, maybe the future lawyers who will be considering this, will be corporate counsels. And your job as a corporate counsel is to help ensure that what the company says doesn't get itself in trouble. And what that often means is be as conservative as possible, say as little as possible, because the more you say, the more you can get yourself into trouble. And so when you make commitments, make them in such a weak way that nobody can hold it against you. That's what the glossies do. That's what the brochures do. That's what the corporate social responsibility statements do. They all sound good, but there is so much wiggle room you can drive a truck through any statement in there. But yes, no questions are a different matter. And that corporate general counsel, if the company had wanted to say yes to, do we make an effort to avoid investments that substantially contribute to genocide, that corporate counsel now, with his neck on the line, if they want to say yes, he'll help ensure that yes is really what they meant. Because no would be a lie, and he can't have lies. You can have marketing, but you can't have lies. So this would turn the tables on how the dynamic works inside the executive offices to do disclosure that means something, that's clear with yeses or noes. Hey, you can still write your essay question answers. You can still have your glossies, but let's look at these yeses and noes. And once you get this idea in your head, I'll bet you could think of a few other areas that would be important for corporate governance or corporate policy to answer in a yes and no format. And if we're successful in making this happen, then I think that documents like a prospectus and risks and purpose and policy may be able to get framed in a whole bunch of areas in ways that will be much more useful than currently disclosure is today. So we're hoping and trying to work towards instituting a different regime for corporate disclosure, starting with the first two questions that I gave you.
Well, I think that's a very thoughtful and powerful reform, and who knows, perhaps there could be some sort of a compromise where Gallagher can get his reforms on the shareholder proposal mechanism in exchange for a greater transparency in the actual disclosures that that all firms are required to make, somewhat along the lines of what you suggest. I think your organization is doing outstanding and innovative work, Eric, and we're really grateful for you taking the time to share with us today the work that Investors Against Genocide is doing. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, David.
So there it is. There's our interview with Eric Cohen of Investors Against Genocide. Such a smart, thoughtful guy. And what I really appreciate from my conversation with Eric is the fact that he's clearly highly intelligent, clearly highly learned on these issues, but is not particularly concerned with squaring the conceptual circle on the architecture of our financial or corporate system as it connects with corporate social responsibility concerns, but rather is concerned himself with what he and his group can actually do to make changes with respect to support, the support of capital, the support of American workers, unknowingly, unwittingly, for regimes that are engaging in, as he put it, war against their own people, genocidal campaigns in the Sudan and elsewhere. My view from the conceptual high is, as always, uncertain and provisional, but I will make the claim that I don't think that a sufficient response to this problem that's highlighted in this podcast is to say that investors should take upon themselves the moral and practical responsibility to know where their money is put in terms of their retirement funds, their savings funds, and to know what the companies that they're invested in are doing in the Sudan. That is an unrealistic, implausible, undesirable course to a greater social responsibility in our investing practices, to a greater social responsibility in our savings practices. Rather, the lesson for me that I take from it is that we need reform in the governance structures of our corporate operations, our financial services companies, that instruct them to take more seriously their responsibilities to attend to a broader array of interests than merely the bottom line return on investments that they are managing. This cannot come as merely a moral call or a request for them to change their own attitude, but rather must take the form of legal reform, of policy reform, that invites and requires management of these large financial institutions in our society to reconceptualize their role. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.